KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. After a brief respite where I was dealing with not only the joys of having a now 3-month-old baby boy, but also getting over the remnants of one of those wonderful spring colds, I'm very pleased to have a new show today, and a show where I'm interviewing a very interesting guest, John Ficarra. John Ficarra, among many other things, is the author of a book from 2005 called In the Bubble, subtitled Designing in a Complex World. And one of the focuses of Hearsay Culture, for anyone that's listened, for any length of time, is the design process. I haven't had on as many guests as I would like discussing the design side of technology, the people and the ideas and the theories that go into creating the software, hardware, and indeed all of the applications that individuals use the world over. And I'm very pleased to have on one of the leading experts and leading thinkers in the area of design. In the Bubble is a reference to air traffic controllers, and I will actually ask John in a few moments to identify what that title means and how he came to it. But the focus of John's book, and indeed the focus of a lot of the work that John has done, is to look at the design process itself. That is the inputs that go into the creation of all of the applications I previously mentioned. And in John's book, he goes through a dazzling array of information, designers and programs and theories and ideas, in coming up with what he basically, and I'll let him go into more detail about it, talks about his 10 design theories or 10 ways of life or inputs of life that go in, that should at least be considered with respect to the design process. And unfortunately, as is always the case in a 1-hour show, I can't get into the level of detail that I might like to really delve into everything. But at least today, we'll be able to discuss with John some of the main points of the book, and indeed explore some of these ideas. John's pedigree is quite impressive, and indeed he's written a number of books in this area. He identifies himself as a symposiarch on his website, thakara.com, which, by the way, is T-H-A-C-K-A-R-A, who designs events, projects, and organizations. He's the director of Doors of Perception, which according to his website, is a design futures network with offices in Amsterdam and Bangalore. It's a conference that occurs, I think, on a yearly basis, although we could get into more detail on that. But it focuses, again, on this idea of connecting, as he says on his website, a worldwide network of visionary designers, thinkers, and grassroots innovators. He's also been involved in a number of organizations that in the design area. He's a former journalist and publisher and first director of the Netherlands Design Institute, which we'll also discuss in a little more detail. He edited Design Magazine for 5 years. Was later modern culture editor of Harper's and Queen, and was design correspondent of The Guardian. Among other books, he wrote Design After Modernism, Beyond the Object, and Lost in Space, A Traveler's Tale. And In the Bubble is the book, however, that we'll be discussing today. So I'm very excited to have on John Ficarra, joining me from France, in fact, by telephone. And I look forward to having the discussion. So after a brief music break, we'll return with John Ficarra, author of In the Bubble, Designing in a Complex World, on KZSU and Hearsay Culture. If I have done my job properly, at the other end of the line is John Ficarra. John, are you there?
I'm here, and happy to be here.
Thank you very much for joining me on Hearsay Culture today. I guess it's late in the day where you are, or at least later in the day than it is. We're actually recording the show on the day that's going to be aired, April 25th. So, John, let's dive right in and with the title of your book. What does it mean, and if you could explain that in the context of your background and how you came to write about this topic, that would be wonderful.
Well, In the Bubble is a term I heard used by people who study air traffic controllers when they're in the control tower, who have to deal with this very scary-sounding mixture of information flows, things on screens, people making telephone calls. They have these bits of wood and paper that they use to represent the position of aircraft in time and space. And it's extraordinarily complicated, as we know, in a kind of small way as observers and users of their system. But they talk about In the Bubble as partly being physically up the control tower, but it's also a state of mind that they have when they're really able to balance these multiple information flows, the multiple kind of inputs, the multiple environmental stimuli that they have to deal with. And it just struck me then, this was a number of years ago now, as something which was representative of the kind of world we all have to live in if we're dealing with technology and deploying it into the world and trying to understand how to do our jobs properly. So it's not that I answer the question in the bubble, but it's a kind of an ideal state to aspire to. That's, I guess, where I started from.
Is the concept of in the bubble the idea, maybe you can expand on a little bit, that people need to be totally immersed in this world of design, and that or that they become totally immersed in it and in some way lose other perspectives and other inputs that are necessary in the design process?
I think that, I don't want to be too abstract about this, the conclusion I came to after spending 5 years working on this book was we need both. We need to be inside the situations that we're designing for a lot, so that we're not looking godlike on them from outside. But we also need that sense of looking at the bigger picture and be reflecting on the kind of more abstract side of things. So it's a very demanding task that we make to people, saying, well, get in there, get dirty, get down and into the wetness of the world, as some of the software people talk about it. But at the same time, we need clarity and a kind of a big picture. So that's why designing anything to do with technology, systems, services, with any kind of serious respect for human and user input is a complicated thing to do these days.
For, unfortunately, oftentimes, stateside here in the U.S., we're not as familiar with things that are going on in Europe, and vice versa, just to a large degree. So for those listeners who aren't familiar with you and your work, perhaps a little more detailed background on what I offered in order to contextualize the conversation would be great. Describe a little bit more Doors to Perception and some of your background work that leads you to look in this area.
Well, Doors of Perception is at heart a conference, although it has a website attached to it and a whole lot of people around the world who are part of our very informal club that started in 1993 in Amsterdam when, if for those of you who are old enough to remember, the internet boom was just beginning. And I was lucky at that time to be starting up a new design institute in the Netherlands called the Netherlands Design Institute. And its task, the government and the profession said, was, don't just tell us what we're doing now, tell us what we should be thinking about next. And so I arrived to do that rather nice job more or less at the same moment as the internet and new technology kind of craze was starting. So we did the first Doors of Perception at the end of 1993, really to answer this question. You know, yes, this new technology, this internet sounds amazing, but what is it for? And that question, what is it for, has resonated pretty much ever since. Because our experience then, back in 93, and yeah, pretty much until now, is that technology providers and infrastructure builders are very good at telling us what things will do, but they've not really been terribly imaginative or inspiring in terms of what it's for. So I think that we have, in Doors of Perception, tried to fill that gap called, yes, it's amazing, but let's find something useful to do with it.
The question of what is it for, I agree, is often overlooked. And I'm curious to probe that a little bit before we get into some of the details of your book. As you speak to people, and this book has been out now since 2005, as you've gone around and discussed your book and discussed your ideas with people, I imagine you get a wide range of opinions. You get people who are technologists and people who are involved in the technology world and deal with it on a daily, if not hourly, minute basis, who might be more interested and more understanding of the question of what is it for than perhaps others that aren't as immersed in it, whether, you know, for whatever reason. I'm curious to get your perception of the what is it for question, how it resonates with those two groups, the people that are immersed in technology and the people that still, in one way or another, are quite wary of it.
Well, I think that the what is it for question has become completely clear in the last 2 or 3 years by complete happy luck, really. And the what is it for question is to do with sustainability, climate change, and the notion of a one planet life or a one planet economy. When we started, the technology was by itself very interesting, but it's just extraordinary to me. I do travel a lot doing my own damage to the climate with carbon emissions as I do so.
Uh-huh.
But it's, I've been for 20 years now with others studying and discussing what this notion of sustainability and climate change might mean for our technology-based world. But it's only in the last 2 years that this has gone up several gears, if I can mix metaphors. And pretty much everywhere I go, people say, how do we reorganize the world so it's sustainable? That's the biggest question of all. And what I did in the book, in my book, In the Bubble, was to break that enormous question down into 10 aspects of daily life that makes a kind of divides up daily life that we all experience as, okay, in lots of the way we move around, the way we live in our houses, the way we grow food, and so on, these are all damaging activities in the way we organize them. How do we redesign these daily life processes using technology as a tool to do that? So that's pretty much where we've got to.
And I think that's a good jumping off point to get into the book. I do want to ask one last background question. I have to confess ignorance. But as I mentioned on your webpage, you describe yourself as a symposiarch. What is that?
Well, it's a very obscure word, and I wish I could pretend to be a Greek scholar, but somebody else gave me that as a present. The symposiarch is somebody who designs or architects symposiums.
Makes sense.
Goes back, it's a nice story. It goes back to Greek democracy, when there was a difference between what happened in the daytime in the formal arena of people kind of standing up in their togas and making speeches in a very formal sense, which, like politics then and now, is probably less important than what happened in the evening when people started to eat and drink and really kind of let loose a bit. And the task of the symposiarch was to organize this evening discussion and to do two things. One was to say, okay, here, gentlemen, I'm afraid it was all men in those days, here is our topic for this evening. And then secondly, the symposiarch had to make sure that everybody contributed and took part and didn't just kind of watch or spectate. And the symposiarch had these two sanctions. And the first one was, if somebody was sitting there silently and not contributing, the symposiarch would say, drink more. You're not saying anything. You're just being a kind of hanger-on here.
Uh-huh.
And if the person persisted in not contributing, the symposiarch would say, okay, that's it. Take all your clothes off and stand on the table until you've said something interesting. So that is the extreme interpretation of my job. And I do a lot of the first one called, you know, have a drink and start chatting.
Yeah, right.
The second bit I'm not
allowed to do. Yeah, I was about to say that might skew some of the attendees of your conferences if
exactly.
You use the latter.
Exactly.
Well, thank you, because that's certainly a word I wasn't familiar with, and I appreciate the elucidation. Let's get right into your book, and you started talking about it, but you know, in a nutshell, what is your thesis? You talk about the innovation dilemma. So perhaps in the context of that as a jumping off point, describing the thesis of your book would be useful.
It's what we just said in the introduction is that my thesis, the innovation dilemma is we know what technology can do, but we don't know always what it is for. And when we don't have a clear idea about what it's for, the trouble is we start to try and force technology as a solution to questions for which it's maybe not an appropriate answer, and which is where all over the world and in many aspects of daily life we find that technology becomes an obstacle and not just doesn't make things easier.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, how do we intelligently ask that question before we do something rather than afterwards? That's the question being, you know, in what way will technology make this task or this activity or this situation better for us in our daily lives? And I think that, as I said, in general, the much more powerful question is the sort of fourth question: in what ways will the use of technology make this an environmentally lighter activity or an environmentally more efficient product or an environmentally more efficient activity? If we don't ask that question, we will end up sort of putting more technology into the world without it delivering kind of practical benefits to people in their daily lives and, crucially, without it improving our environmental performance.
You talked about lightness, and indeed that's one of the 10 design principles, if you will, that you identify in the book. I could probably walk away from the mic for a half hour at least with the following question, so I'm not asking for a long answer, but for the benefit of the listeners, can you identify the 10 design principles that you mentioned and very briefly, perhaps in a sentence or two, it sounds like an exam question now, explain what they mean?
Well, I think the lightness thing to me is the whole story about In the Bubble hangs on this, because the dilemma we face is that the world seems to be going to in a very bad direction in terms of its environmental performance, despite our best intentions. And there's a kind of huge mismatch between the amount of resources that we use to make things and to organize life, on the one hand, and what we actually see or perceive on the other. So, for example, a laptop computer, this is a famous example that Paul Hawken and Amory Lovins have written about in a book called Natural Capitalism. You know, most of us, I guess, listening now have a laptop computer which weighs, what, 2, 3, 4 pounds in our laps. But when you add, as the American Society of Engineers has done, together all the resources that are used to manufacture it, distribute it, package it, put it in a shop, deliver it to our home, power it up for its life, and so on, you get to a staggering figure of 4,000 pounds of weight that are used in the life cycle of one single laptop computer.
That's incredible.
It is incredible, and it's done and footnoted and peer-reviewed by, you know, eminent engineers, so it's not something I made up. And what I just told you about a laptop applies to every kind of artifact in our lives. The cars are, of course, worth. Houses, chairs, T-shirts, you know, a cotton T-shirt weighing a few ounces. Once you've added up the kind of the energy and the chemicals used to grow the cotton, the processing of it, the machining of it, the packaging of it, the flying of it around the world, the putting it into the shop under the bright lights, etc., etc., a little T-shirt weighs many, many pounds in terms of its life cycle impact on the environment. And that's why, for somebody in an advanced industrial country, what the Germans call the rucksack, or the ecological rucksack that we all carry around, is something staggering like 1 million pounds of weight when you add up all these kind of resource wastages. So I talk about lightness, and that's something that's important for designers, because designers have only recently become properly aware of these staggering kind of hidden histories of products that they design. I don't blame designers for that, because, like the rest of us, it's really comparatively recently that we've had to deal with this question of sustainability in a tall, serious way.
Mm-hmm.
But once you start to understand that how much waste and kind of the profligate use of matter and energy that goes into our materialistic lifestyle, changing it is not a small question. But the beauty of lightness is that you can't have too much of it, so that's why I made it the first chapter in the Bubble. Every time you make something lighter, whether it's a car or a laptop or a T-shirt or a packet of cereal, it means you use less resources, which is good for the planet, but it in general also means that you spend less money on those resources,
mm-hmm.
so it becomes a more profitable thing as a business. So in general, lightness is a win-win design target.
Mm-hmm. The other nine we can get to in a moment, because it does, it got me thinking about something which I want to run by you. Jamie Boyle, the professor of law at Duke University here in the United States, coined the term cultural environmentalism about 11-12 years ago. And in the context of what he was discussing, he was talking about the, for those that are trying to reform or reconsider the way technology is created, especially with respect to intellectual property rights, but generally with respect to how it's created itself, that movement can take a look at the environmental movement for some of its progenitors. But also, it discusses more of a holistic approach with respect to the creation process itself, the idea that code is law, that's been developed by Larry Lessig, for whom I work, and others. I'm curious to get your reaction to it with respect to the question of whether you view yourself in a sense as an environmentalist, perhaps not a cultural environmentalist as I've defined it, or maybe you are, but as an environmentalist generally, and how the environmental concerns that you've raised, which aren't discussed as much as perhaps they should be, merge with your interest in technology and design.
I don't have any special claim to be a kind of a seer or having come to this subject before anybody else. I've been for 20 years perplexed by the rather clunky applications that technology tends to get used for, and I'm saying that, as I said in our conference, there must be better ideas than this applied to more or less everything. And I think that, along with everybody else, I'm just beginning to realize the enormity of the challenge that we face in increasing our resource efficiency by a factor of 10 or 20 times in a couple of generations to come. So we're not talking about tinkering with our economic or social system here. We're talking about completely transforming it. But I don't think it's I know what you mean about cultural environmentalism, and I think that's a starting point. We need an image or a picture in our minds of how life could be different in order to be innovative and design stuff to be better.
Mm-hmm.
The danger with this notion of cultural environmentalism is that you have something over on the left field called doing good and being ethical and taking care of the planet and drowning polar bears and all that kind of stuff. And on the other hand, you have science, business, spreadsheets, profit and loss accounts. And I think the only way we will have a chance is if these two worlds are brought together, which is why I think scientists and engineers and business leaders have the crucial role to play in setting targets that are based on scientific evidence, but also are clearly there for all of us to see, so that we don't kind of deviate into thinking kind of warm thoughts about the environment when really we have to be confronted by hard choices.
The you're going in a lot of interesting directions, and I want to probe them a little bit before getting into some of the details of some of these ideas, especially lightness. But I'm curious again, having being a symposiarch, as you identify yourself, and speaking to a wide variety of people, you know, both in Europe and the United States and elsewhere in the world, do you see those two worlds merging, which I'll generally term the business world and the academic world? How much of that is happening now? Because clearly there is an echo chamber effect that exists in a number of groups, but it does seem to be, anecdotally, just by observation, that there seems to be an increasing dialogue between those two spheres, if you will. What's your sense of that?
No, I think it's incredible the amount and the degree of change that's happening right now in the last 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you just one example. The chief executive of Unilever, which is one of the world's largest consumer goods companies, made a speech just a few months ago in which he said that the 240,000 staff of Unilever had to contemplate a complete and radical transformation of their business rather quickly based on what he, in his own words, described as new design principles that would transform the way that they thought about resources, resources in their case being water, detergents, power, and so on. Very, very radical from the head of a very kind of mainstream multinational company.
Mm-hmm.
I've encountered people from the logistics industry. I was at a seminar for the managers of one of the top four logistics companies where they said very kind of clearly that we have to contemplate a world in which we don't fly airplanes full of packages around anymore. I have various colleagues who've worked for the big supermarket companies like Walmart and Tesco who tell me that the very top people are contemplating, and not just contemplating, but taking action to change things in a very radical way in a rather short number of years, far more quickly and far more radically than any politician or any environmental kind of think tank or any UN body seems to be daring to do. So business, I think, is more tuned into two things. One is the evidence, because they live or die by whether they make correct decisions, and secondly by the sensibility of the people who say we don't want platitudes anymore. We don't want to be told that things will get a bit better. We want things to change radically, and I think the businesses are responding and moving much, much faster than most politicians.
And to what do you ascribe this rather sudden change?
I think it's probably not sudden. I mean, I think that the whole story of this climate change and something must be done goes back to 1964 when Rachel Carson wrote A Silent Spring. And since then, there's been a growing crescendo of discussion. And then since the early 1990s, when the first the body on climate change, the UN Global Federation of Scientists, started to publish seriously peer-reviewed prognostications, all of which got steadily worse, a lot of politicians and a lot of media people said, well, but this is not yet proven. I think business people are more realistic, and they say it may not be proven 100%, but if this is even half likely to be half true, we are going to have to do something pretty drastic, otherwise our market and our world will disappear. And I think that that I think companies are just more tuned into risk than politicians. Politicians try to avoid confronting unpleasant decisions as long as possible. Companies try to anticipate them and act in advance, which I think is a fundamental difference.
Mm-hmm. With regard to the topic of innovation, before we take a break, I do want to probe one of the phrases that you used right in the introduction of the book, and it kind of gets us into the break, and then when we come back, we can dive into lightness and locality and learning and flow and some of the other ideas you come through. But you say, and I'm quoting you, you're looking for innovation driven by science fiction, moving to, quote, innovation inspired by social fiction. What do you mean by that?
I think that most people in the world are motivated by their daily lives as human beings in social situations with their families, with their children, with their communities, and do not necessarily welcome technology that comes along that promises them to have less people involved in their daily lives than there are now. So that science fiction promises all sorts of things which may or may not be possible in the future to do with technology changing things. Social fiction puts people at the center of the story and says, okay, here is our daily life as a worker, as a parent, as a food grower or whatever. How might our social economic life be different if we reorganize things, but without writing human beings out of the picture? I think that the really crazy thing to me of the last 150 years is that we've had this idea that progress means to have less human beings involved in our daily life activities, which I haven't yet in my whole life met somebody who welcomes that, but that's the logic of what innovation or technology-driven innovation is about. We will replace people with machines. Nobody ever has in the last 150 years welcomed that except technology pushers, and I think that's kind of a story that's run its course, and the next 20, 30 years is going to be, how do we put people back into the picture? And secondly, how do we create business models that allow them to be paid?
The fear of computers taking over and eliminating human beings for any purpose for which we are designed with respect to our brains has been a fear, I think, going back to the dawn of the machine. But certainly as computers became more powerful starting in the 60s, that concern continued. And, you know, with respect to automation generally, going to the assembly line, and Frederick Taylor is a student of labor economics, that's also a topic which has continued to concern and fascinate, but also exhilarate some, especially in the production process, perhaps more so than design. And I think this is a good time for a break here on Hearsay Culture. But when we return, I want to discuss with you a little bit about some of the details with respect to some of these design principles. So you're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU Stanford, interviewing and talking with the author of In the Bubble, Designing in a Complex World, John Thakara. We're going to take a short music break, and we'll come back to continue the discussion. We're back on Hearsay Culture, and before we continue the conversation with John Thakara, author of In the Bubble, it's now the time on the show where I ask you for money. KZSU is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station that relies on the donations of listeners to continue its innovative, using the phrase of the day, or the word of the day, programming. If you're interested in learning more about making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do hope that you'll continue to listen. So we're back with John Thakara. And John, let's dive into some of these concepts that you mentioned before coming back to the issue of people and how they fit into this. And you mentioned lightness, and we discussed it briefly at the beginning, and you identified it as the major focus of the book, and indeed anyone who reads the book can see that that's a concern of yours. I kind of want to talk a little bit about some of these entities that, in fact, are taking a look at this issue, that is commercial entities that are looking at this. And you mentioned a company called, I may not pronounce it probably, Prey, P-R-E. Who are they, and what's, talk a little bit about the software they've created, because it was quite interesting to me, and how it's being used.
Yeah, Prey Consultants are a Dutch group that make tools to help people measure the total life cycle of a product, be it, as I said earlier, whether it's a car or a laptop computer or a T-shirt. And what they do is to provide a whole range of tools that a company or an individual can use to begin to get a grip on this very complicated story about the inputs of energy, materials, into all the different aspects of something such as the manufacturing or the packaging or the distribution or the retailing, all these different things that go on without us necessarily thinking about it. And they give you a kind of a number that you can then start to tackle. And you can say, well, by the way, we're spending X percent of the resources or the money on distribution costs. How do we reduce those? It's a kind of one of these rather fast-growing support industries called information for sustainability that enables us to be more precise and more objective about how to change things for the better.
Is there a market for this company in both in North America and in Europe? It sounds like there is.
I think the market is exploding, albeit from a low base. I mean, let me give you another example. I mean, many of us think that trains are a more kind of progressive way to move around than in cars or Learjets or whatever. Some Germans at the Wuppertal Institute, who are also provide services for industry, have done this extraordinary kind of measurement of every kind of aspect of what it takes to build a high-speed train system, ranging from digging rock out of the ground right at the beginning through to constructing the vehicles that move along the trains, the electricity used to power them, and even up to, you know, the amount of energy required to put bottled water on the train for the passengers. An extraordinary wealth of detail, and that's being applied, this notion of life cycle analysis or material flow analysis. In Europe, it's become quite a large part of the kind of innovation industry in which people say, well, it's not about being having good intentions. We're going to put numbers on these problems and on these challenges, and we're going to set targets called let's reduce by 10%, 15% per year, per season. And where I think the big change is the transition from good intentions to measurable targets.
Is the corollary to that the concept of benchmarking that has been around for a number of years in management, or is it something a little different?
Well, I think the difference is, and I'm not at all sure that we're there yet, is we have to not just compare ourselves to other actors in the market. So it's not really good enough for my car to be 10% more eco-efficient than your car.
Mm-hmm.
We actually need to look at the bigger picture about the total environmental impact of mobility as a whole, and then say, what is our target? So, for example, there's a man called George Monbiot, an English writer and scientist, who has looked at the subject of aviation as a whole, and as well as measuring the emissions of aeroplanes as they fly around, he's looked at all the evidence to do with, airport buildings, ground vehicles, electricity used to power the displays in the cafe, all of that, and has come up with some very alarming numbers about the true environmental impact on aviation as a whole, and then has said, okay, supposing that all the people in the world had an equal ration of carbon emissions, which is equal to the capacity of the Earth to absorb them, it's a big story. He said, you get a number, which is number X, and then that number gives you an entitlement to a certain amount of air travel, which I have to say is almost none at all, but we're moving from this kind of sense of a fear and big, scary, abstract dangers called, the danger to the planet, towards numbers being applied to stuff. And I think that makes a profound difference, and it's why business is beginning to move from denial to proactive preparation.
It's an interesting phenomenon, and we see it on the law side as a lawyer. One of the areas that's a very hot topic the world over is digital rights management. And indeed, just, adding evidence to your, conclusion that a lot has changed in the last 12 months. Just in the last few months, we've seen major industry leaders like Steve Jobs identify DRM as maybe something that's not necessary in order to capture rights. And, of course, for those that view intellectual property rights as directly impacting innovation process, both positively and negatively, which is to say most people, for those that are viewing the rights package, as it were, as being more skewed right now towards industry, it's encouraging to hear people like that say these things. And I'm not sure that that Steve Jobs' motivation for it is the same as what you're describing. But having said that, it's interesting to see this dialogue occurring as opposed to what has been, I think, at least recently, more of a reactionary position than one of dialogue, which I guess...
Well, I have an interesting example for you. I was in Italy last week, and everybody says, well, you can't ask people to fly less, you can't ask people to consume less, you can't ask people to sacrifice their lifestyles for something very abstract like the future fate of the planet. And I think that's partly true. But I had this curious experience of going to Italy where, for any of you, your listeners who've been there, people used to smoke heavily in public places, restaurants and bars.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of a European kind of legislative program, they were one of the first countries to say, no, you cannot smoke in restaurants or public places. And everybody, without exception, said, they'll never buy it. The Italians won't swallow this. They're far too independently minded. But the amazing thing is that everybody in Italy has obeyed this law with barely a whimper of protest because in a curious way, they just know it's in their best interest. They may not like it, and they may not appreciate governments telling them what to do. They may certainly, you know, object to the notion of big brothers overlooking their private lives. But when push comes to shove, they've given up smoking. I think that when it comes to profound environmental sort of challenges like you have to fly less, we have to kind of drive around in big cars less, or whatever, I think that people will basically adapt without as much fuss as we think they're going to make. And that's why governments have a pretty important role to play in setting benchmarks and frameworks and saying, okay, let's suppose that everybody in the world has an allowance for their carbon emissions. This will mean sacrifices at one level, but I've suddenly realized in the last few months that I think people are going to go along with it.
Do you think designers will? Because your book certainly, and you've said on the show, that you don't think that the designers are the main problem. And yet these are the people who are designing the very softwares that we're discussing. So I'm wondering whether you think that the designers themselves are going to go along, or in fact are going along, as readily as some of the other groups you've described.
Well, there's two stories here. One is that, by most accounts, the environmental impact of a product or a service or a building or a T-shirt is 80% of its environmental impact is determined at the design stage. It's not really something that we as citizens can control by making choices in shops. All the decisions are made by designers in the innovation process determine how damaging a thing is to the biosphere. But the design process is not per se the same thing as individual designers. So, you know, many designers work for employers who do things such as gas-guzzling cars or wasteful buildings or, very expensive, materially expensive products, which they know and everybody knows are bad for the environment in one way or another and don't feel happy about it. But I don't think you can blame individual designers for that. So what I say and what all over the world I'm experiencing now is that designers are saying, well, actually we have helped to create a big part of this problem, but we also have a responsibility and perhaps the capability to be part of the solution. So if people can design products to be environmentally damaging, they can also design products that are not environmentally damaging or that are much lighter or use far less resources. The difference being that they can't do it on their own. So indeed, the old model of design is you have some clever person sitting in a studio doodling on a car or a T-shirt or a laptop computer. Nowadays, they're going to have to be part of the kind of populace more generally. We have to come up with these solutions collaboratively. And that's the big shift towards sustainable design, is that we're all going to be involved.
It kind of leads me to another point that you make in the book under the heading of locality. You use the simple phrase, use, not own. How does that fit in, and what do you mean by that?
Well, this is something that a great American writer called Bruce Sterling first started talking about when he told me many years ago that the average power drill that you or I might use to put up a bookshelf is used for 10 minutes in its entire life. And a kind of 5 kilos in your hand, or 5 pounds in your hand power drill, like the laptop, like the car, like the T-shirt, probably costs thousands of pounds of resources to make, and yet we only use it for 10 minutes? It's completely mad. Why not have some kind of infrastructure of information, smart tags, websites, and mobile phones, whatever, so that when you say, okay, I have to put up a bookshelf, where is there a power drill that I can use to do that? And the system locates a power drill somewhere nearby. Many of these elements of such a service already exist in embryo. Then we would need far, far less power drills than we have now, and all that wasted stuff could be removed from the equation. And so using not only means having access to a piece of equipment or to a service, or for that matter a human being, when you need it, but not having it in your private possession with all the kind of waste that entails.
Is the overarching idea with respect to the production process that there are indeed and they exist ways to create and design that have less environmental impact and they exist now and they can be done but they are not or perhaps they are more recently, or is it that we need to come up with, in other words, they don't exist, ways to create in a lighter, more local way?
You put your finger on the most important issue of all. I don't measure it, but I think that 95% of the answers that we need to live sustainably already exist somewhere in the world. They may not exist in the developed industrial world. They may even have died out in some way and be, you know, practices such as different ways of growing food that have been allowed to disappear or wither away. Most of the answers exist somewhere, and that's why I tell designers they have to think of themselves more as hunter-gatherers and searchers out of solutions that already exist somewhere, rather than feeling that they have to invent something out of thin air or in a blue sky sense. I mean, food is the obvious example. I had an extraordinary encounter with some people from Toronto recently who have measured the impact of the so-called advanced organization of their city on their ecological footprint. 25% of the ecological footprint of Toronto comes from the industrialized food system, which we've invented over the last sort of 50 years. If they could find a way to grow more food in Toronto, either in the city itself or very nearby, prepare it themselves, eat it in a kind of local way, you're talking about a vast reduction in their ecological footprint just by thinking about food. Those solutions all exist. Somebody in Toronto knows how to grow food in window boxes, back gardens, on the roof of apartment blocks. Somebody in Toronto knows how to find a good use for when there's an oversupply of eggplants. Somebody knows how to bottle it. Somebody knows how to put it in, keep it through the winter. All that knowledge exists somewhere to solve 25% of the ecological footprint of Toronto. It's just a question of using that knowledge in a smarter way. And by the way, people are starting to do that. That's what's so exciting.
The ways that people can enter this design field is kind of a good way to start wrapping up the show in about the 5 minutes or so that we have left, which is to focus on this other idea that you mentioned, the idea of flow. Again, I'm asking rather open-ended questions, but I think they fit together. What do you mean by flow? And to use your phrase, how can it, quote, enhance the kinds of daily life that we experience here and now?
I think that this is the chapter in the Bubble on Flow is really asking not just designers, but the people who use design, which is all of us basically, not just to think about products in a kind of as if they exist by themselves, but to try and always look for the flows of materials, the flows of energy, the flows of money, the flows of time even, as part of the hidden story of the things that surround us. Because once you become sensitive and critical about, as a consumer, about, well, how much time has been involved in producing this thing, how much energy, how much waste will be required if I get rid of it, you suddenly, I think, everybody I know, once you start to become sensitive, you realize how crazy many of these products are that come into our lives in terms of how wasteful they are. And if you can be critical of flows, it's not such a big step to say, okay, let's see if we can do this thing, getting food, moving around our town, heating our house. Let's see if we can use less energy, less waste to achieve the same result, and in other words, have a better quality of life or the same quality of life, but using far less wasteful ways to do that. So flow has two meanings. It has flow as a kind of part of the problem, flows of waste, and then also flows of doing things in a smarter way. And everywhere I go, I meet literally hundreds of people who are being tremendously creative in designing aspects of daily life so they're less wasteful.
And certainly, you know, it's a rather encouraging view, and quite frankly, panning the guests that I've had, you have a much more optimistic view than many of where we're headed with technology, and especially where we're headed with respect to the kinds of technology that are going to incorporate values that you know, we perhaps should, and certainly I think we should share as human beings, but aren't always there. So I'm encouraged to hear your optimistic view of where we're headed, and it kind of leads me to really, which is you know, my last question before we wrap up, which is the idea of ethics and responsibility that you point out, informing design without impacting the social and technological innovation that exists. And oftentimes people do view those two as mutually exclusive. If you were to give one piece of advice with respect to how to merge those two to a designer, what would it be?
It would be to think about the consequences of your actions as a designer before you take them rather than afterwards, which many designers think, oh my God, that means I can't be creative or I have to be conservative and boring. Not at all. Just be aware that when you design the production of a thing, that thing will require energy and materials to be made, and we all need to know in the future whether this is a justifiable action to take. When designers say, yes, but that means I have to stop being creative, I say, no. Is there a more interesting way to deliver the performance of that thing than an object, which is a wasteful thing, that can help people? Can you heat somebody's house without having a large, wasteful boiler in the basement? Mm-hmm. Can you get somebody to move around a town without doing so in a large, clunky vehicle? Can you have lunch without having supermarkets full of freezers and lights and packaging and all that kind of stuff, which contributes nothing to your nutrition? If you pose people the right question, people can be, you know, very creative, and that's what I basically say. You know, be creative, but don't equate creativity with producing more stuff.
For those that want to learn more about these issues, what resources or websites would you recommend?
I'm happy to recommend doorsofperception.com. That's one word, because that's just the starting point for these debates. And more importantly, we, I think, ask to be challenged. I mean, it's very easy for me to say things on your nice radio show, but I think our job as communicators and designers is to get many more people discussing these questions. So mm-hmm. doorsofperception.com is probably the best place to start. And if anybody has questions about the issues that I've raised, I'm happy if they email me to give them sort of to point them in other directions, not just to my activities, but to other people's books and websites, because I think we should all be doing that.
And what email address would they use?
This would be john@doorsofperception.com.
John, thank you so much for being on a show today. I actually hope to attend one of your conferences in the near future, but I appreciate you taking the time today to be on the show and discuss these issues, and I invite you back to a follow-up to see where we're headed maybe in a year or so.
It's a great pleasure, Dave, and thank you very much for having me on your show, and good morning to all your listeners.
A pleasure. Thank you very much, John. John's book, In the Bubble, is a wealth of information, and certainly we can only touch the tip of the iceberg here today in the hour-long show. So I thank John again for being on today. I'm looking forward to having on a few more interesting guests. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, between my son and being a little under the weather, the last few shows have had to change time. But I'm pleased to mention that Bob Markley, who was previously scheduled earlier in April, will be on next Wednesday to discuss his book, Virtual Realities and Their Discontents. We also had some technological snafus, which also have made it somewhat difficult, but we're back in the saddle here and moving forward. So Bob Markley will be on next Wednesday, followed by a couple of hopefully at least one live guest on May 9th. Balazs Bodo, who is a visiting Fulbright researcher with CIS, is going to be on to discuss socio-cultural impacts of technology, particularly the impact of technology in what amounts to former Eastern Bloc countries, and how technology can open up those doors of information. Followed on May 16th by Tony Falzone, for whom I work, and who is the director of the Fair Use Project at Stanford, something affiliated and run by CIS. So I'm looking forward to having Tony on. And then going into late May, we will be talking to Jennifer Granick, for whom I also work. So I'm back to interviewing people that I answer to, but I promise to be certainly as unbiased and as clear as I can be under the construct of speaking to my current employers. But Jennifer will be on. She was on the show early on in its inception, but will be on to discuss robotics along with her husband, Brad Stone of the New York Times. So I'm looking forward to having my first two-person interview live in the studio, followed at the end of the month, at the end of May, with Professor Michael Shanks of the Metamedia Lab here at Stanford. Starting in June, I'm going to be airing some recorded shows over the summer, shows that I'm going to be putting together over the next 6 weeks, and that schedule can all be found on hearsayculture.com, the website for the show. As always, you can find the show in a number of ways. You can either listen live, certainly streaming is the best option, live on kzsu.stanford.edu. It's kzsulive.stanford.edu for the streaming. But you can also always find the show by podcast either at the website dedicated to the show, hearsayculture.com, or on the podcast feed for CIS's webpage, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And finally, you can also find it on the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society, which is located simply by going to iTunes and typing Center for Internet and Society. So I want to thank you today for listening to Hearsay Culture. Please stay tuned for Benji. And I look forward to talking to you next week and hopefully having a long and uninterrupted run of new shows here on Hearsay Culture. Have a great day.